You're listening to the Art of Dying Well podcast, making death and dying something we can all talk about.
Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the first Art of Dying Well podcast of 2022. Now, it seems like we're sort of edging out into the light from the pandemic, much as it's not gone away, of course. And we're socialising a bit more, speaking to each other a bit more, listening a little bit more, perhaps. But can we remember how to listen and process properly? Or are we maybe a little bit rusty? Now, that's why I was going to call this particular Art of Dying Well the Art of Listening Well, or maybe perhaps the Art of Conversing Well. And that's what we want to look at today. Breaking bad news, consoling people, exploring feelings and emotions, having those meaningful, tender conversations in the face of challenging circumstances. That's really what we're about for the next hour or so. And I'm delighted to say that our first guest has been on this podcast before, her third appearance, no less. And that's the gem, the delight, the wonderful Dr. Catherine Mannix. Catherine, what a total joy. How are you doing?
Oh, thank you for that lovely introduction. I feel like I'm a serial offender. I'm very fine and I'm delighted to be talking to you again. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, as you can tell, I'm rather enthusiastic about it. A palliative care specialist, we've mentioned that several times. Cognitive behaviour therapist, I didn't know that, actually. I read that on the sleeve of the book that we're going to talk about, and I didn't know that. Now, you've spent thousands of hours, as we've said many times, helping at the bedsides of thousands of people. But now you're a world-famous author, I would say, helping all of us with your books. And we're going to talk about listen. How to find words for tender conversations. Now, we've talked about your first book in the past, With the End in Mind, which is an excellent book, I have to say. And I'll come on, I'll have a little story about that a little bit later on. But in this, it's the sort of, well, you tell a lot of stories. We talk about the common element of a conversation needing to be a collaboration. So I'm going to throw one at you, actually, fresh from your book. This is using your own information at you here. In the getting started section, I'm going to say, where would you like to start?
Okay, that's rather lovely. One of the things that I realised once people started writing to me about the first book, which was intended to be the only book, that was it, because I didn't think I was a writer. I thought I was a doctor who wrote a book, which is not the same thing. And I got lots and lots of letters from people saying, you've convinced us we need to talk about this stuff, but I don't know how to start. My family won't let me. I'm really worried that if I open it up, we'll never go back to normal again. You know, all those things about a daunting conversation that make it something you don't know how to start. And a lot of it was about, I don't know how to start, or I don't know what to say. So I then started to realise that even though I had no intention of writing another book, I did know an awful lot about these conversations and how to get in gently and how to stay alongside soothingly and how to finish safely. And maybe I could write about that. But the tone of the letters was all about what to say or how to start. And it seemed to me that what people thought needed to happen was that the other person needed to be given a really good talking to. And as I stopped to really think, well, what does happen when we're having those conversations, you know, going back through not just my palliative care practice now, but my cognitive therapy practice, or just, you know, being a mum or managing a service or helping trainees who are feeling their way into their training or whatever. Almost all of those really important conversations are mainly listening. It's giving somebody a really good listening to. And the best way in is not to suddenly plonk down in front of them and say, right, you, we're going to talk about this. It's to give them the option of whether they'd like to talk about it or not. So I think, as you just did, the way in that we don't really think about, but when things go well, is usually what we've done. Is we've done it by mutual consent, which means that at some point we've given an invitation.
Now that leads me It might seem like an obvious question, but it's something that I think, long before I read your book, actually, I've been a bit preoccupied with. What is good listening or good hearing?
What's good listening is actually in the eye of the speaker, isn't it? It's how well does the speaker feel listened to? And we know there are some things that help people to feel listened to or stop people from feeling listened to. So you know when you're trying to tell somebody something and they change the subject, that you're not being listened to. Or you try to tell somebody something and they say, oh, I know exactly what you mean. Now, when I was 17, and they tell you their story that they think is exactly like your story, of course it's nothing like your story at all. That's somebody who's really trying to join in, but they've turned it into it being about them. So I guess the hallmarks of really good listening are that it stays centred on either the subject you've both agreed you're going to talk about or the dilemma that the person being listened to is trying to explore and find ways through. And the listener doesn't talk very much because they're listening and uses their curiosity to just keep checking back. Have I really understood this? Is there any other bit of this that I've left out that I haven't asked you about? They're summarizing back. And sometimes when you hear somebody summarizing back, it gives you an insight you hadn't had before. Even when they've summarized back wrong, you realize what's right by noticing what they didn't get right. So gradually.
So there's some value in that, actually, in not maybe listening or hearing correctly. There's still some value in it getting you to the right place in the end, maybe.
Absolutely. So if you think about it as a process, the conversation is a shared endeavor, isn't it? And if I'm listening to you and you're describing your dilemma, your difficult situation, you're wondering about whether to do this thing at work or have this conversation with a member of your family, whatever it is, if I'm there as your supporter and we trust each other, I should be able to say to you, so is it about this aspect of it then, James? And for you to be able to think, is it? Oh, yeah, partly it is. Or to be able to say, no, actually, it isn't. Okay, that's a bit of clarity. It isn't about that. So what is it about? And it's not like the helper got something wrong, because it isn't about being right and wrong. It's about being curious. And for children who are the role models for curiosity, anything is possible. So they ask tons and tons of questions and we give them information and they gradually work out how stuff is and they start to understand the world and they classify things. We're doing that. We're being a curious listener. And if we ask a question that isn't a particularly helpful question, that's okay, because there are other questions we can ask too.
Do you know what I find fascinating about the book? And I think maybe when we all read books and we're all sort of maybe trying to glean whatever we can so we can improve how we tackle certain things, such as a sensitive, challenging conversation, you sort of think to yourself, oh, must remember that. That's really good. That will help me. Oh, must remember that. Must remember that. And then it actually happens. And you sort of find your brain going almost like a flow chart inside going, okay, I need to go from this to this to this. Did I hear properly there? Did I do this? Did I respond in the right way? Can it get a little bit robotic like that or systematic rather than human? How do you sort of, it's quite a dilemma, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you want to respond in a human way. And in the other hand, as I did, I've read the book and thought, okay, I need to be doing these things. How do you keep those things in mind that will help you, whereas not appearing like a robot when you want to appear like a human?
That's a brilliant, brilliant question. So when I was starting to think about how to frame the different skills that we use, my original metaphor was that it was like a toolkit. I was going to make the book like a toolkit. And then as I was starting to develop it, I realized that doesn't quite work, because with a toolkit, you pick up one tool and you use it, and then you put it down to pick up the next tool to do the next thing. And that isn't what's happening in a conversation, because you're going to carry on listening. You're going to carry on being interested. You're going to carry on being kind. And sometimes you're going to ask a question. Sometimes you're going to make a summary. Sometimes you're going to go back to something that you said a few minutes ago, because actually when you said that before, I thought you meant this, but now I'm thinking about, you know, so you're really showing that you're paying attention by going backwards and forwards in the conversation. And I realized actually dancing is a much better metaphor. And when you're learning to dance or you're learning to ride a bike, you're trying to keep all of the things in your head at the same time of moving to the rhythm or pointing the handlebars in the right direction and not stopping pedaling, even though you feel yourself wobble, that kind of thing. I like the dance metaphor because if you think about ballroom dancing or something like that, it involves two people. And we're both doing our best and we're both working together. And the dance is the collaboration between us. Yeah. And we're both trying not to trip each other up and not to tread on each other's toes. But we might even fall over. But we'll both know that was an accident and we'll help each other to get up and dust each other down and get on with it again. So dancing is a really rich metaphor. So thinking about your kind of clunky, am I doing step A and then step B? Well, that is how it feels when you're learning to dance. Left foot, right foot, slow, slow, quick, quick, slow. But eventually what happens is you've done it enough times that you trust yourself. And in listening, I think you've done it enough times that you just trust that going in with a good intention, maintaining a focus on what the person wants to talk about, and simply collaborating, being curious, offering back what you've heard so far so that you've checked it out, and not getting in the way by giving advice or giving reassurance, which feels like the right thing to do, but actually just, you know, that's what we think rather than what they thought of. If we just trust that that is essentially the thing to do, we can stop thinking about the algorithm and we can just go with the flow in the same way as we will sway with the rhythm of the music and we'll move in time to the music and then eventually we'll use the correct foot in the correct sequence. But if you use the wrong foot first, hey, you're still moving with the music, you're still dancing.
Yeah, I think using the wrong foot 3/4 of the way in isn't quite so bad. I don't know if you've had this, I certainly have, where you know it's a tough conversation, you're having it, and then you start to do the terrible thing of slightly patting yourself on the back because it's going quite well. Have you ever done that? And I'm thinking, wow, you know, not to be the hero, but goodness me, I'm quite pleased. I was dreading this and it's going okay. And then you say something either dumb or, you know, this is like the metaphor, I suppose. You then tread on their toe. It's going great. You're swaying nicely. You tread on their toe. And then you have that recovery process where you're like, oh, no, didn't mean that. And they look at you, you know, then you suddenly realize you've got it all wrong. The misstep, I suppose. But can you recover from a misstep halfway through?
And I think you can. I think once we've established that what we're here to do is support each other, then after that, it's okay to get things wrong because the intention is kind. The intention is good. The intention is worthy and the other person knows that. And so to be able to actually have the courage to say, you know what, that just came out of my mouth all wrong, or that didn't sound like that in my head. I'm sorry, that sounds really clumsy. That sounded really insensitive. Can I say that a different way? Can I cross that out altogether? And
because they can see you're backpedaling, can't they? They know full well you're backpedaling on the direction you went in with that.
Yeah. And so when it's with a friend or a person in your family who you already have a good relationship with anyway, to just get out of your own head that you're not going to destroy your lifelong relationship by saying one inept thing during this important conversation. That if it's a professional conversation, perhaps we feel a little bit more anxious. You're meeting somebody for the first time and you're having to deal with telling them, you know, really unwelcome news about, you know, how knackered their car is and how much money it's going to cost to fix it, or, you know, bad result of their recent health tests and what it might mean, whatever it is. We might say something that they're not quite ready to hear yet. It's the truth, but we haven't softened the path to that place adequately. And it feels like a slap to them. But we can see that that's happened. And Sam, I'm really sorry. I can see that's really shocked you. Or I can see you weren't ready to hear that. I'm really sorry. And then perhaps the most important step of all is the being with somebody in their distress, because they just need a companion while they quietly take that in. So knowing when to stop talking be present alongside somebody who is just actually taking in that replacing the rear springs on their car is going to cost more money than they've actually got in the bank account. But if they don't do that, they can't do the school run. Or actually, these blood tests suggest now that you need to have some scans. And yes, we are looking for a really serious illness on these scans. There isn't a way of making that kind of bad news better news. We just have to be alongside somebody where they just take that in and work out how they're going to deal with it.
Well, I think we'll come on to silence because you mentioned silence in the book a fair bit as well. But on a similar level, let's pick up on what you've just said, actually, and talk about when words fail you a little bit. Actions speak louder than words. How often have we heard that particular phrase used? Now, I'm going to talk about your previous book, but only for a little bit of context. I've got a very dear friend of mine and his lovely family, and their son was diagnosed with cancer when he was mid-teens, very young. Went into remission, it all looked okay. And then, as these things sometimes do, tragically, came back when he turned 20 and then very quickly deteriorated. And, you know, I present this podcast. I thought to myself I would be able to speak to my friend, who I obviously know very well. We've broached many, many subjects over many, many years with one another. And I found myself, literally, the words failed me. I didn't know what to do. I shocked myself, actually, by not knowing what to do. And you, without knowing it, actually came to the rescue. I don't know if it was because I was quite desperate at that point and thought, well, what do I do? I don't have the words I thought I would have, and I don't. I saw your book. I was literally just thinking about what I might say next time I saw him, or what if I give him a call, what am I going to say? Or if I go around and see him, what am I going to say? And I saw your book, and I thought, well, actually, I got a lot of wisdom out of that. I found it quite consoling as well, and I wonder if he might feel the same. So I remember when I was waiting around at his place, because I was trying to help out in some small way when his son was coming home, I just took the cover off because I didn't want the big words with the end in mind to be too alarming. And I just popped it on the third shelf up in this particular room I was in, and then gently directed him to it via a message. And sometime later, his son sadly died. It was you know, a real tragedy. Broke us all up, really. He said, well, actually, the book really helped me during those precious final moments. And I believe others in the family too. So I sort of wanted to bring that up because words failed me. And I was able to use the book, your first book, to actually help. And he said it was very, very helpful. I didn't know how it would help, if it would help, to what extent it would help. But it certainly did that. So I guess sometimes when words fail you, you can use the words of others, can't you?
Yeah, that's a lovely story. Thank you. Thank you for telling me that. And yeah, we do get stuck, don't we? Even those of us who it is our life's work to be engaged in conversations that can be very, very emotionally charged with strangers, with people who are not our friends and family. Somehow it's different when they are our people. It feels different, doesn't it? It absolutely does. And I do think that it's okay to say, I don't know what to say. I'm just going to sit here and be with you for as long as that's going to be helpful. But I've got nothing here. Actually, that task of just saying, I don't know what I can do that will help, but I'm prepared to be here in the dark with you. I think that's a really important part of the tenderness in these conversations. And Brené Brown talks about this absolutely beautifully. The idea of the people who come along to try to help by pointing out to you that at least it's not as bad as this and at least it's not as bad as that. Well, have you thought of, and they make all of their suggestions. And of course, if it was as simple as any of those suggestions that I can think of, you would have solved it by now. So sometimes all we can do is sit in the dark beside you and say, this is really hard, isn't it? Here I am.
Yeah. And that actually was, I think that's the way. That's the way when words fail you. So let's talk about silence then, because I was listening to a piece you did with Michael Rosen, and you said that with a master communicator, there's a lot of silence. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. Now, we're going to speak to our resident poet, Audrey Arden-Jones, about silence and the place of silence. From a broadcasting perspective, I've always been taught that silence is your enemy. You can't have dead airtime. You've got to keep it going. You've got to keep people talking. What's going to happen? Is the station tape going to kick in because it's detected too much silence? So silence is my enemy in a sense. But in a tender conversation, tell me how silence is my friend.
So when you think about thinking, when you think about doing that work inside you where you're turning over all these different, almost imponderable possibilities of how your situation might play out, the person who's doing that thinking is in a really intense place. Their concentration is very, very focused. And they're doing the work of starting to understand the dilemma or starting to reach towards possible solutions. And if we carry on talking at them, we interrupt the work that they are doing. And yet, of course, in the same way as you can't have radio silence, during COVID, most of these conversations weren't face to face. We weren't sitting in a room with a sick person or with their relatives and a cup of tea and a box of tissues, able to just, you know, with our body language, show that we are remaining attentive. We have to find ways of doing that on the phone. You know, you don't even know that the line is still attached if there is complete silence. So there are things we can do that say, I'm still here, but don't call the person out of their silent place of contemplation. So just to be saying things like, this is really hard. I'm sorry this hurts so much. I'm still here. Take your time. Gosh, this is loads to think about, isn't it? They're compassionate, short statements of presence that don't require them to think about what you're saying. They are simply signals that you are still there. And so in a way, they're still silence as far as the person who's doing their thinking is concerned. They're not calling them out of their place of contemplation back to your agenda. So silence is the place where the work happens. Silence is the place where we make our minds up about things. Silence is the place where we change our minds about things. It's a really important part of the conversation. And what's very interesting is when you videotape consultation, and we do that quite a lot when people are learning their communication skills, young healthcare professionals, for example, they'll come out of the taping session and they'll say, oh, that silence took forever. Oh, that was awful. And then the other person will come out and say, well, that was really helpful. You know, what about that really long silence? What really long silence? And of course, it wasn't silent for them because they were busy in their head doing the work that the silence gave them.
That's fascinating. Because silence, I suppose I had it in my head that positive silence is quite visual. So those excellent tips you gave about, you know, filling silence in a non-intrusive way on the phone or in an audio conversation where you can't see the face. You know, you often hear that phrase, don't you? Oh, that's a bit awkward. That's an awkward silence or a difficult silence or, oh, why have they gone silent all of a sudden? But actually, you can just use your face if you're not covered in PPE. I mean, we've talked about that before, haven't we? Silence can be made more comfortable or made to feel important for the person that you're talking to visually, can't it?
It absolutely can. And one of the things that I learned a lot about during COVID, I was invited to help make some unwelcome news training materials for NHS staff. And that was a really fascinating thing to do. But we got huge help from Professor Ruth Parry and her team of academics at Loughborough University, who are conversation analysts. All this stuff about conversation that you kind of know, but you didn't know that you knew. For example, that we seem to be primed as animals to communicate by conversation, taking turns. And from being babies, we make a babbly babbly noise at a baby will make a babbly babbly noise back at us, and then it stops and waits for us to do it again. And they know about taking turns. Amazing. So one of the things about conversations analysis is not just the words that we use and the silences that we leave, but the other behaviours that help or get in the way of the conversation. And one of those is the way we look at each other. So in a conversation where we're taking turns, some of the time we're looking at each other, but a lot of the time we're not. We're looking away into the middle distance while we think our thoughts. And we get very hung up on gaze, you know, somehow we have to be in direct eye contact in order to have a deeply meaningful conversation. And yet, I bet you know, and I certainly know from my family experience, that some of our most deep conversations have been in the car when the driver cannot possibly give you deep eye gaze because that's just not safe. Or when you're out walking with somebody side by side, and if you're not going to fall over, you really need to look where you're going. So giving attention is signaled by gaze, but it doesn't have to be intense eye lock gaze. But one of the things that we do is we signal to each other that it's your turn now. So I finish my kind of rambling monologue and I fall silent, but I'm still looking downwards and you know that I'm still thinking and I haven't finished yet. Or I finish my rambling monologue and I fall silent and then I look at you and that's a signal that it's your turn now. And it gets even more complicated than that because you might even think she's still sitting on something there. So you now gaze downwards to say, I defer my go. And I might now say something more that expands on the monologue that I took in my previous turn. So it's like a very, very complicated card game where we're giving each other cards, exchanging cards, or choosing to keep the cards and stick or twist. It's fascinating reading the research.
You got me a bit worried now. I hope the boffins at Loughborough University aren't marking me for my conversing skills with you now. They might be. I might be making some classic errors. Who knows?
Well, what's beautiful about what they do is they take feedback from the participants at the end of the conversation about how much the person felt that they were listened to, kept safe, dealt with compassionately, had things that they wanted to address properly addressed. And then what they'll do is go through the conversation to see what are the things that correlate with those positive outcomes. Or if a person felt that they weren't held in compassion, can you see where in the conversation the dip happened that they perceived as a lack of compassion? So it's all about helping to build up the behaviours of good listening. And again, they've got beautiful things on their training site that include how you repair after a rupture, that actually it's a stronger relationship if you make a mistake, apologize for the mistake, are not trying to make yourself better, but make the situation better. Actually, that builds the person's trust in you as a person who's safe to talk to and who's got their well-being at heart. So it's really, really interesting that what the research shows very much it chimes with your inner understanding of the people you like to talk to and feel safe with and the people you wouldn't tell your secrets to for reasons that you've never really fathomed. But when you read this research, you realise what they do are those behaviours that don't help you to feel safe.
Yeah, and that's what we were talking about a little bit earlier, wasn't it, with the missteps and the... I like what you say, actually, about the just sort of kind of being honest about it, having a bit of self-accountability, I suppose, a bit of humility, a little bit of, the, you know, being able to say, actually, I got it wrong. It's not a perfect conversation in that sense, and I got it wrong. So I love that about the way you do that, because there are ways of saying sorry, aren't there, as well, of course. You can do it in a way that seems like you're perhaps trying to make yourself feel better, as you say, or genuinely, well, I didn't want to put you in a more distressed position through my words when all I was trying to do was, you know. So that's delicate, isn't it? The art of the apology is quite a delicate one.
Yeah, but isn't it all about the humility that comes with it? I think you're right, humility is the right word, you know, and just to be able to say to somebody, do you know what, I've just got this awful feeling that I just said something, I'm not even sure what it was that I said that's hurt you, that's made this worse, that's taken us three steps backwards, and I'm really sorry. If you know what it is, can we talk about that? How can I
Because their tone changes, doesn't it? You sort of always have, I think, a little bit of an inkling you might have taken it down the wrong path. But then it's when the person straightens a bit, maybe, or puts a quizzical look on their face, or starts to talk to you in a more monotone, direct way, and you think, oh, this was very compassionate and an exchange, and it was nice, and now it isn't anymore. So I feel I have kind of made a misstep. So there are, again, it's those visual indicators, isn't it? You can work out where you've gone wrong, certainly if you can see someone's face, because you can start to try and work out where the conversation's gone.
Exactly so. And because we like to be polite to each other, if you say, oh, did I say something wrong? They'll say, oh, no.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, whereas if you say, I can feel that I just said something that wasn't the best thing to say. I don't know what it was. I'm really sorry. Help me understand. We were talking about this, and now suddenly I can feel that you seem a bit uncomfortable. I'm really sorry, whatever I did. Can we go back to this bit and take it from there? And that's like a dance, isn't it? Let's go back to when we were both standing up, reset the music, and let's keep going.
Yeah, very good point. Now, what I love about you, actually, and I don't want this to be a total love-in. I mean, I'm sort of letting my admiration for you come forth a bit too much, perhaps. But I love the way you do broach those things, that honesty in looking at where things could go better, or and the lovely tone you always have. I think tone is so important that you get away with a few missteps if you genuinely come across, you know, as if you care, because you do, obviously. And I think a lot of people listening to the Art of Dying Well podcast, I mean, much as I think our conversation today has underpinned this throughout, are going to be asking that question, you know, how do I break bad news? So without pushing you towards the toolkit you did not want this to become, what would you say to people that are specifically struggling with that, you know, either how do I break bad news, or how do I talk to someone who's had bad news broken to them?
Yeah. So the first thing to notice is the reason that we feel awkward about it is because we know it matters. So it's not that we don't want to talk about it because we don't care. It's because we do care. So first of all, give yourself a point for caring enough to want to do it well. And then I'm thinking we'll have listeners who are ill and need to tell their families about the illness and they don't want people to be sad. We'll have listeners who are worried about the well-being of relatives or changes that they've seen in those people, maybe physical changes or maybe memory or emotional changes, and they want to try and find out more, but they're worried that it might be perceived as prying or unwelcome attention. So all of the reasons that stop us from stepping forward are about concern and love, and that's okay. So let's just recognize that before we start. Mostly because we're talking about people who we are in relationship with, issuing the invitation is probably the best place to start. So next time your dad has a really forgetty moment, to then say, Dad, you've had a few forgetty moments recently. Is that something you would like to talk about sometime? Doesn't have to be now, but I just wonder whether it worries you a bit. And, you know, that might be, oh, do you know what? I'm not worried about me forgetting. Your mother's even worse. Or, no. That, you know, they're not ready to go there yet. So because it's an invitation, they do have the right to say no, as well as to accept the invitation, and we have to accept that. Or to be able to say to the family that, you know, I have some news to tell you. When would be a good time for us to sit down together to do that? And if the family already know that you've been having tests, or you were treated for a really serious illness a few years ago and everybody hoped it was over, they will immediately feel concerned and they will try to make themselves available as much as they can, as soon as they can. So those are things to think about, issuing the invitation. One of the things I get a lot of questions about is adult children wanting to know what their parents or, you know, people that they have kind of responsibility towards, older relatives, want or don't want in terms of healthcare in the future. And they can't get into that conversation because the older adult doesn't want to talk about that or feels that it's intrusive to be asked about that or whatever else is going on. And one of the ways that I've learned from people who've done this successfully is that if we try to kind of parent our older relatives, now, come on, Mum, we need to talk about this. That's not going anywhere, is it? That's really undermining who she is. She is an adult in her own right and has had parental or, you know, aunt looking after duties with regard to you for much of your life. So it's very undermining if we start to take over. But what we can do is go back into that valued relationship of you are an older, wiser person who's always looked out for me and take it that way. So I'm worrying about something and it's causing me a lot of concern. You know, sometimes I even wake up in the middle of the night worrying about it. And I'd really like to be able to talk to you about it. Now, nobody who has a caring concern for you is going to turn that request down. And the request doesn't have to be, I want you to write out your advance plan for your end-of-life care. The request is something as simple as, because I'm your closest relative, or because I'm the relative who lives closest to the hospital you'd get taken to if you were really sick, or because my phone number is in the doctor's notes or whatever, I just really worry that if something happened and you got really sick and the doctors couldn't get your opinion from you and they turned to me to say, what would you want? I just don't know what to say because you and I have never talked about it. I could make some guesses, but I'm really worried that I might be wrong. How would you feel about us just taking 10, 15 minutes to mull that over just so I've got some kind of guide in case that ever happens. And then I can stop worrying about it and sleep. And you will know that I'll have your back if I ever need to speak for you.
Oh, that's superb. Now, I think I told you we'd only be half an hour, didn't I, at the start of this? I think it's been absolutely fascinating. I've enjoyed it very much. There's lots more we could have talked about. The book is packed full of wisdom, packed full of charm, lovely stories. I think you're such a good storyteller and it's a really good way of getting that teaching out, actually, much as I know you don't want it to be specifically a toolkit, but I'm sure it will help lots and lots of people. Listen, how to find words for tender conversations. I found it very useful. I know everybody out there will find it useful. What's the next one? What's the next book?
I'm thinking about that.
You're allowed time and silence and space to consider it, I'm sure.
Thank you.
Catherine, thank you so much. As always, a good friend of The Art of Dying Well, always there when we ask you. And I know you're very busy. So it's been a pleasure. Lovely to see you. And thank you very much.
Oh, the pleasure's all mine. Thank you very much. Thanks, James.
The Art of Dying Well podcast is on Amazon, Audible, and Google Podcasts. So ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode.
Yes, indeed. We're all about the high tech, artificial intelligence and all that. Whether your voice assistant of choice is Siri, Alexa or Google, so vain that it's named after itself, we'd like you to ask it to subscribe you to the Art of Dying Well podcast. What have you got to lose? Go on, do that for us. Right. Now's quite a good opportunity to remind you that we do carry all our podcast interviews on YouTube. Well, at least one per episode, and more if we can squeeze it in, of course. So if you like what you've just heard from Catherine Mannix, maybe you'd like to put a face to the name if you haven't already done so. Head over to the Art of Dying Well YouTube channel. We'll post the full interview over there, which means there's a bonus 20 minutes or so. Plus, if you want to have a little gander at a lovely little loft in the northeast of England, if that tickles your fancy, you'll see that as well. www.youtube.com, The Art of Dying Well. I know sometimes we put the in The Art of Dying Well. So apologies for any confusion. The Art of Dying Well. Right, let's forge on with the art of listening well, the art of the tender conversation. We've decided to roll Death Chatter and The Voice from the Bedside Chair into one today as we welcome back Audrey Arden-Jones to the podcast. Audrey was last with us in episode 25 and returns now for
The Voice from the Bedside Chair.
a bit of a treat at the end of our podcast today, because the voice from the bedside chair comes from Audrey Arden-Jones. Now, those with a sharp ear might well remember that we've had Audrey on before. And I'm going to get a bit carried away and describe Audrey as our resident poet. Now, I'm sure you remember those lovely poems that Audrey read to us before, and we have three more for you today. Audrey, how lovely to see you. How are you doing?
Thank you, James. I'm very pleased to see you too, and to be with you on this programme.
Absolutely. Now, I should, you know, it is kind of sad times globally. I think we can't ignore that. And the reason I bring this up is that in episode 25, Diagnosing Dying, that you kindly contributed to, I do remember you mentioning at the end of the piece, at the end of Doing the Rounds, in fact, the book, the final poem, you were talking about something that now looks rather prophetic, really, because your mother was from Ukraine. And so with these terrible, devastating conflict that's going on right now, this must be touching your heart somewhat.
Yes, I'm afraid, James, it's left me feeling absolutely devastated, because a poem that's in that book, Doing the Rounds, it's called The 4th of March, 2014, is a poem which I wrote when the Russians invaded Crimea. And funnily enough, I have actually last night written another poem about how I felt, that it linked up with my mother and the terrible trauma she and her family had at that time when the Russians invaded, and how my mother escaped, luckily for her, but not without a lot of ongoing psychological trauma that was to haunt her for her life, and of the terrible things that are going on now, and how the people, you know, must be feeling. It really has affected me. So, you know, that my thoughts are completely with what's going on.
Yeah, and ours too, of course. Now, we're talking about reflective things. We're talking about tender conversations, listening in particular. But you and I were talking a bit off mic about stillness, calm, solitude, and even you mentioned, Audrey, being alone in the sort of early days as a district nurse, kind of before, in the pre-hospice period, because obviously we know you were a senior nurse at the Royal Marsden for many years and have a lot of experience at the bedside, literally. But you had those times, didn't you, in the early days on your own, where there was all that space to reflect and think and process all the things that you were going through in your experiences.
Yes, do you know, James, I feel really honoured to have had 13 years, you know, working funny hours, as often mothers do with young families, to fit in. We set up what was called the Twilight Service, the Night Service in this area, and there were no hospices. So the terminally sick patients were looked after by nurses like myself. And, you know, it was such an honour. We did everything for them. And as I said, you know, it was on your own. I would be with patients and families and spend quite a good deal of time, you know, caring for them in their last days and talking with the families. And I was saying to you earlier, James, and I'm very pleased that things have moved on with regard to communication and the attitudes of openness that now exist with families about understanding what was going on, which in those days there was still a feeling of, you know, the patient might not know quite what's going on, but actually they did, because they would then confide to me, well, my husband doesn't realize, and so on. But it was very wonderful time, and I was able to be very innovative because I was there. And I remember, you know, using skills such as gently rubbing cream into patients' hands who actually were not being touched, because when somebody's very sick and they've lost a lot of weight and they change, sometimes the partner finds it very hard to physically touch the person that's so ill. And I remember how appreciated patients were when I used to say, can I rub some of your baby oil on your arms and your hands, and just to be there for them. And it was a great honour. And those patients live with me. I haven't forgotten any of them. So
it's beautiful.
Yeah, a big part of my life.
And I was talking to Catherine Mannix about, I mean, many things, of course, you know, techniques to have a collaborative conversation, an exchange where one feels listened to. And a big part of that was silence. And you and I have talked about silence on many occasions. And I recall her saying that we call silence awkward, but silence is where the work's happening. Is that something you'd echo?
Yes, I would echo that very much. And one of the things that always has stayed with me, which was written by the philosopher and writer Heidegger, and it's a quote, and it goes, "It's not only what is said, but what is unsaid." And that has always stayed with me. That was sort of like the backbone of my research that I was involved with. And I was at the Royal Marsden looking at how people felt about diagnoses, which were, you know, pretty shattering and terrible, because my work was involved with families with genes, and some of the patients that I saw were very, very sick, and then had the added information that they may be carrying a deleterious gene that could be possibly passed on to their children. And that statement about not what only is said that is unsaid makes you think of looking very carefully at someone you're sharing a moment with, looking how they hold their head, they turn their face, the way they move their hands, the whole of their being, their expression, and to understand something that perhaps can't be said. And that, I think, is, you know, not just for that person who's suffering, but it's for whoever's sharing in that, the family members. And often in a situation when somebody's very sick, there's quite a few people that are involved, and all that, listening to the voices of the people who are talking to you, how they express the words they use. And for me, the work that I did, the research that I was involved with, because of my interest in writing and poetry, has always been interested in language and the words people use to express themselves, because that tells me quite a good deal about what's happening and how they're feeling.
In those bedside conversations, of which you've had very many of them, what would you say you've learnt about those times where it hasn't gone well with a delicate conversation, a tender conversation?
Thinking back to, I think I did tell you a story, James, a while ago, about a lady who was impatient because she didn't really know how much longer she could cope with caring for her very sick husband. She was getting impatient, actually. And what she hadn't realised at that time, and I think more people are made aware of this, is that for that patient who looked perhaps as though they weren't taking anything in, that listening, their hearing, is actually the last thing to go. And I had to gently remove this slightly irate lady from her bedroom where she was looking after her husband, who was worrying about when she could next go shopping, into another room and say to her, look, you know, you must realise that, you know, perhaps your husband can hear what you're saying, although he doesn't look as though he can. And I think she was quite taken aback by that, but she had been very outspoken and probably inappropriate. And it was just, you know, a difficult scenario, but I you know, I've never forgotten that. You know, thinking about people saying the wrong thing. I mean, we often do say the wrong thing unintentionally. It's normal, you know, that you might just say something that you think, oh, I shouldn't have said that. Life, you know, is at these times delicate. Sometimes people be very angry, and angry with those people who are trying to help. And as we all know that families can be very split at difficult times. Somebody hasn't got on with someone and they, you know, don't want to see that sister. And I've got, because of my work in genetics, you know, a lot of family members that had fallen out previously, then having to be involved with that person and, you know, returning to a bedside where they perhaps are unwanted is difficult. There's no getting around it. Thinking back to the subject matter of silence, there is a music, I think, in silence, real music in it, because it speaks on its own. Good listening may involve touch, holding someone's hand, letting them feel comfortable to talk. Just using your expression to appreciate what they're saying, you may find that you're welling up with tears yourself, because that certainly happened to me. You know, if it's right and it's comfortable, lean forward and put your arms around that person. You know, it may just be a natural thing in that environment, allowing the time to go on, not feeling you've got to say something, leaving the spaces. Don't have to say something. Just let the space take its time.
Yeah, well, I was actually very moved by what you said at the start of this about, you know, rubbing the cream, the oil into the hands of those very near the end when they're so very frail. So it is, isn't it? It's a mixture of actions and words, and maybe, you know, when it's right to leave the words, some actions, whether they're physical, whether they're subtle, whether they're maybe just a gentle nod, you know, showing someone you're giving them the space to think, to maybe cry or experience those emotions, those human emotions we all feel.
Exactly. I'm thinking back to someone that I was close with, and I know she loved flowers. And I remember putting her favourite flowers on the bedside and just sitting with her, telling her about these flowers. And she was on, you know, days before she was going, but I know that even though she couldn't respond, she could hear me and know that those favourite flowers were beside her. And also thinking back to listening, one of the things that I also was involved with quite recently was actually playing music to someone who was taking some while, longer than the doctors had expected, to leave this world, and playing, you know, favourite music and hymns. And again, that was listening, because knowing hearing is the last of the senses to go, knowing that the favourite music of that person, in fact, it was hymns and songs that she loved, and some of the hymns that were to be played at her funeral, that felt right.
Well, that musical example is perfect, actually, because that quite literally is listening before leaving. Now, I think you know where I'm going to go with this. Tell us about listening before leaving, because we are rather privileged to have had a poem written especially for our podcast, haven't we?
I mean, I always think this is such a wonderful program that you do, James, and it's just such an honor to be part of it. And so I thought, you know, I would have a little try at writing something. And I think you saw a couple of versions. You know, they always take a bit of time to edit and to get to something that seems genuine. And you do, you know, as a poet, you draw on the things that you've read, that you remembered somewhere in your unconscious that has meant something to you. Otherwise, it's a pointless poem, to be honest. It becomes perhaps a very clever piece of writing. But if it hasn't got the soul, what I call in it, or the emotion, then I don't think it works. So this little poem, I've dedicated it to the dying. I've called it Listening Before Leaving. It's for the dying and those who are caring for the dying. Last days, last minutes of life, time sacred, time to listen, hands in hands and playing music, a favourite piece again and again, whispers in prayers, whispers in songs, time to be, to feel air, to feel the summer warmth of closeness, knowing leave we must and trust we must, knowing hearing is the last to leave us, sounds of sunlight splintering through a shifting sky, flocks of birds listening.
Joe, I love that. I love that in particular because, and I think it's quite natural for people to do this, but you sort of project yourself sometimes into these situations, don't you? It's a difficult subject, thinking of one's own mortality, one's own death. But I was listening to your poem thinking, actually, that would be a jolly nice way to die, actually. You know, it made me feel optimistic in something where I might be afraid. I'm not saying every death is like that, but it would be nice to have that reconciled calm and sort of literally the lifting up of the spirit at the very end there. And that's what it said to me.
Thank you, James. Well, you're absolutely right. That is something that would be wonderful if everybody could have that, you know, experience of leaving this world. And we know that that isn't always possible. Some people are in a traumatic scenario and never as easy as one would like to make. Let's go back to the beginnings, a birth of a baby. You know, how wonderful it would be for the baby to slip out and the mother to be able to hold it. But we know ourselves, don't we, that and you've got a few children to remember births. And I have too. And, you know, things don't work out necessarily like that. So to a certain extent, that is idealistic. But why not have a few idealistic thoughts and, you know, the best we can when we can. And that's perhaps, in reality, the truth.
oh, there's nothing wrong with being idealistic. I think sometimes we need the consolation of a fine death, let's say, reconciled death. And what I also like is that it clearly is the culmination of a great number of your experiences at the bedside, isn't it?
Yes, and I think it's known, isn't it, through history with writing and things, that we all lean on nature to help us through things. Perhaps the next poem, which I'm going to read, is called In Stillness, because those of us who are left behind, and this podcast includes all these family members, professionals, or whoever it is, have times when it is really tricky, and it's often in the middle of the night, isn't it, that we wake up, we can't sleep, and we're thinking and we're remembering. So the mind whirls around. So it's always good if we can try and enable ourselves to find a stillness. So this next poem, which is what's called a mirror poem, actually, and the first verse is written, and then the second verse is the first verse upside down. So the words are repeated in a different order. And I think that reflects, in a way, often the way we are when we are involved with somebody who is sick and who maybe dying, is that we do go backwards and forwards in our heads, the way we feel about things. We mirror things and we remember things, don't we, about that person. And so I'll read this little poem, and it's a 4 a.m. poem, and probably most of you can relate to that time when things, you know, are working. And at that time, this is what I wrote. 4 a.m. and light wakes. A moon half hidden behind branches, the silence white, silver-edged, reflective like a mirror. I like this night. The way light soothes, feeds silence in stillness. Outside, the scent of wisteria calms me. Flowers like tiny bells, other worlds, a mysterious time to be, to believe, to know. A mysterious time to be, to believe, to know. Flowers like tiny bells, other worlds. Outside, the scent of wisteria calms me. The way light soothes, feeds silence in stillness. Reflective like a mirror. I like this night. Behind branches, the silence white, silver-edged. 4 a.m. and the light wakes, a moon half hidden.
Wonderful. And once again, has that sort of slightly, I don't know, I almost feel like saying discombobulated tranquility, which might seem like a very strange thing to say, but it's that time of the night, isn't it, where you can be over-processing sometimes, particularly if you've, I guess, especially in your work, especially in the early days as a district nurse, you must have spent many a moon literally in the car at 4 a.m. having had highly emotionally charged situations in the early hours, in those still hours. So I like it very much, but it also, even in its calm, hints at sort of recovery from trauma or a difficult time, a difficult experience. It's almost sort of exhaustion and reflection. It's almost like these things are flooding you, isn't it, after all these experiences.
I think you're absolutely right, and I'm sure other people say the same, you know, that when you are in our role like, you know, carer, you do need a stillness, and you do wake up in the night, and yeah, I think that's absolutely true, James. There's something in that poem that, although it's reflecting on perhaps the beauty, because I did, you know, openly say something about liking the night, and I do like the night. I do like the night because it's away from the chaos of the day and the people. And of course, you know, it's sort of as a district nurse and before as a nurse in hospitals, I also like night duty. I was one of these people that really liked night duty. I find it a different time, a different feeling, and it's always different at night. But to see the light from the moon and the way light changes is almost a metaphorical explanation for the way perhaps life is changing, and maybe night has always been seen as ending, but it isn't always that. It's sometimes the beginning, perhaps, of the way you're handling a situation.
Now, you're going to conclude, aren't you, with a poem that isn't your own, but is nonetheless very appropriate.
Yes, I expect some of you will remember the name Patience Strong. It's a little bit of a corny name. I don't know why I say that. It seems very mean because she was a very prolific writer, and she used to be, I think, and you know, if you've got the woman's own, there'd normally be a little poem by her. But I'm going to read this one about the same topic that we've been chatting about, stillness, and it's listening as well. And I thought it was really beautiful. So thank you, Patience, for your lovely poem. It's called If You Stand Very Still. If you stand very still in the heart of a wood, you will hear many wonderful things, the snap of a twig and the wind in the trees and the whirl of invisible wings. If you stand very still in the turmoil of life and you wait for the voice from within, you'll be led down the way of wisdom and peace through the rough world of chaos and din. If you stand very still and hold on to your faith, you'll get all the help that you ask. You will draw from the silence the things that you need, hope and courage and strength for your task.
Wow, another great selection there. Patience Strong, what a great name, I agree. I mean, yeah. it makes me think of the fact that as humans, we sort of, in a sense, we create our own chaos, don't we? Our own momentum. We always want to be moving forward or doing something. We're not very good at sitting still on the whole and allowing things to happen around us. And what I like about that poem is it's a sort of, it's showing the merits of actually fighting that urge to make noise and keep moving and keep busy. And we always say that, don't we? Even after a bereavement, oh, you must keep busy. You must do this and that. But there's that, obviously, that great value in stillness.
I think the world has moved towards, you know, a lot of people doing mindfulness and taking time out. I think that culture amongst people has shown the benefits of trying to take time out to look after yourself. That's a great thing that people say. I wasn't really brought up with that culture. It wasn't about me. It was always about having to look after someone else. To concentrate on yourself was not the thing I was brought up with, which I realise isn't a particularly good thing. It's much better now that people are encouraged that when life is tough, to take time out. And also, you can't help anyone else unless you're actually okay yourself. And all these emotions, especially going through a, you know, emotional time of love and loss for the person who's looking after other people, you must take time to have that stillness. So it's great that you're bringing that into your work, James. And thank you so much for inviting me to share a few thoughts and poems and to reflect back on my wonderful, wonderful nursing career. I'm actually now what I would call a full-time carer. My husband's not great. And so I'm on the other side now. So that's also interesting. Yeah.
Absolutely. And look, the pleasure's all ours. I'm very grateful that you've given us the time. I sometimes slightly cheekily describe you as our poet in residence. Kind of, well, feel we should be paying you a salary.
I tell you what, being involved with poetry, I mean, also, would I say this to everyone, if you can afford it or what, buy yourself a little book of poems. So therapeutic. You know, you can just have it by your bedside and read a poem a night. And there are so many wonderful volumes. I mean, I can see here in my room a poem for every day of the year. And, you know, you've just opened the book and you can find a beautiful poem. They're everywhere. There's some lovely volumes. And I recommend reading a poem. It's short and it can change your mood, make you feel different and inspire you. And also those of you who perhaps like to write, have a go. Just write. Write while you're sitting with someone. Write your thoughts, your memories of that person. And then you never know. I'm not talking about trying to be famous or published or anything like that. It's just lovely if you've written something and you drop it in a card to someone who's lost someone. I know that when I've done that, it's meant more to someone to have a little few words. And all of you can do, if you can write a shopping list, you can write. I encourage you all to have a go.
You are an inspiration. And I particularly thank you, not just for your wonderful poetry, which you know, I don't ever want to take for granted. I really enjoy your poetry. And I enjoy your curation of other people's as well. You always hit the mark with our particular topic. So very grateful for that. But also, I appreciate your wisdom gleaned from many years of experience and the way you put it across as well. I've been very privileged, actually, on this podcast to speak to two very wise and experienced people who are great communicators and very happy to share their experiences. And of course, all the love in the world to you and all the best with your husband as well, obviously. It must be very poignant, actually, having that, you know, I mean, this the section we've just had with you, Audrey, has been about carers. And I'm glad you've sort of refocused us on those that care, because they're very important to us. So, yeah, thank you ever so much. I know it's not easy to carve out the time, but we are very grateful for all you've done for us.
Well, thank you to you. And thank you to your listeners. Real honour.
The Art of Dying Well podcast is available on Amazon, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. Just search on your preferred platform.
So that's just about it for our podcast on the art of listening well, the art of engaging in tender conversations. Not an easy skill. And I think, as we've learned, not an exact science either. Just like a dance, as Catherine says. There are way too many times that I've put my foot in it, conversationally, for sure. And one or two where I've simply been lost for words, as I confessed a little earlier in this piece. Once again, I've learnt a great deal, and I certainly hope you have too. If you want to read some of those charming stories that Catherine uses to illustrate her words of wisdom and experience, you can get yourself a copy of the book, Listen, How to Find the Words for Tender Conversations. If you're a bookshop person and want to physically pick up a copy, as I hope people still do, Listen is in all good bookshops. And if you're looking online, I won't mention the obvious huge online retailers. I'll just say that it's published by William Collins, williamcollinsbooks.com, just as it sounds. And of course, a simple online search should give you a few purchasing options. I definitely would recommend it. I've made a good few notes, so I'm hoping that I will be able to converse a little better as well. A big thank you to Audrey Arden-Jones. Now, what an honour to have a poem written especially for this episode, Listening Before Leaving. How poignant in these days that that poem is dedicated to the dying and those caring for the dying. Very, very powerful stuff. Just remains for me to say thank you to you for listening, and of course for keeping me company for an hour or so. We'll be back in a couple of months tackling another important topic on the Art of Dying Well podcast. I'll look forward to your company again then. Take care. Bye for now.